I'd like to welcome to Planet Waves FM, making a second appearance in a short time, Michael Bryant from Central New York. Michael, welcome back to Planet Waves FM.
Thanks a lot for having me, Eric.
Michael, you remain one of my favorite writers of this whole thing, somebody really with a voice and a point of view. Today, I'd like to talk with you about the health freedom movement, also sometimes known as the COVID truth movement, that emerged fairly early on in 2020 and has kind of been evolving for a few years. What did you notice at the beginning in terms of the society mounting a response to the claim of a pandemic and the lockdowns?
Well, one of the initial large and what I would say acceptable responses from critics of the beginning phase of COVID manifested itself in what is called the Great Barrington Declaration. And at its core, the Great Barrington Declaration was essentially saying that, yes, we have a pandemic. How it's being handled by governmental and medical bodies in the United States goes against all that we know about pandemics. It is a flawed policy, and here are the protocols that we see as being effective in dealing with and treating this pandemic. Okay, so they were highly critical of the government response, but where I see this to be quite flawed, and this is one of the foundational documents early on of what would be called, the health freedom movement, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Where I see it as being flawed is it accepted as an a priori assumption that there was a pandemic.
Yep, and this is a very important point that, as I think, misunderstood. You recently submitted an article to me that begins basically, thing one, there was no pandemic.
Yes, and so from my vantage point, I'm hearing this and I'm reading these kind of things that the acceptance of the pandemic was widespread, and you really couldn't criticize that at first from the COVID skeptics movement per se, but I'm looking at data and evidence and seeing something that is entirely different, as well as understanding the history of these fraudulent pandemics, dating all the way back to, HIV and AIDS, but,
way
certainly
before.
2005 and then 2009 with swine flu hoax and all this.
76, another flu hoax in 76.
Swine flu hoax in 76 even, I mean, nothing had come to be, such a cataclysmic event, quote unquote, as COVID, but essentially, what I'm looking at is, wait a minute, they're killing a bunch of people from institutional settings, mainly nursing homes and hospice and this sort of thing. This isn't a pandemic. This is an administrative act.
Yes. There seemed to be a lot of clues. There was not actually a health emergency from very early on.
Yeah, so I would say certainly personally in my community when I would vocalize this, I would be getting a lot of criticism, but even in the online world where you're discussing this matter with other people who are skeptics of much of the COVID narrative, they still seem to be pretty attached to this idea that there was this pandemic, this viral event that we needed to handle in some way. They still seem to be, a lot of people still seem to be sucked into this fear narrative, and in doing so, we're ignoring a whole host of evidence out there that was pointing quite clearly that no, there really wasn't any medical emergency.
Yeah, I mean, examples of that are there's only any anything significant for any period of time in 15 states. Is that right?
Yeah. So out of the 51 states, including D.C., yeah, there were only 15 states. This is in March, April 2020, that were experiencing anything that you could call a matter of concern as relates to mortality statistics. And, so with these 15 states, you know, it was fairly curious that they did border other states that were having no notable difference in their mortality during that time. And same is true for Canada. You know, Canada's quite a long border to the U.S., and Canada was not experiencing the same thing. Now, the exception to this was a jurisdiction in Quebec. And what was interesting about that is in that jurisdiction in Quebec, they were using essentially the same administrative mandates that you found in these other 15 states that were essentially wiping out a lot of elderly people. And that's what was happening in these 15 states. And in these 15 states, it was only happening in very concentrated areas. So it isn't as if this was spreading throughout the states, as one would have to believe if they were to accept this pandemic narrative.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, for example, I live in Kingston, New York. It is about as far of a suburb from New York City as you can get. But it's a lot of commuters. There's commuter buses and a bus terminal three blocks from my home, and the trains are packed going up and down from Rhinecliff every day. But even though there was said to be, you know, sheer hell going on in New York City, somehow there is allegedly a contagious viral disease, people packed into trains and buses, coming back up daily during the peak, prior to something being locked down, and nothing going on up here.
Yeah, so there's a lot of, I think a lot of people have stories like this, and, you know, you're looking around, supposedly there's this incredibly transmissible and deadly thing out there, and, you know, you're walking around your daily life and seeing that, well, none of this seems to be impacting me or people I know, and yet we live in, you know, close proximity to where we're being told this. All of this is happening. You know, I have somewhat of an interesting personal story on this without going into the specifics on it too much. You know, I, in January, February of 2020, I'm in quite close contact with a lot of Chinese foreign nationals who had just returned from their homeland, as well as close contact with a lot of New York City kids who would be coming back from their holiday vacations, and large numbers of New York City kids, you know, going back to college. And so I'm around all these people constantly, day in and day out, hours, and nobody is getting sick. There's nothing happening. And then all of a sudden, we start to hear all of these media reports, and people are still looking around going, wait, there's nothing happening. What's going on here?
Yep. Yeah, and it's amazing what you can tell people is happening on a news report, and they think it is. It's the World War of the Worlds effect, where there was no alien invasion in 1938, but people were certainly acting like there was one.
Yep, that's certainly what it seemed to be. So, you know, if you're someone who's been aware of these other hoaxes, you know, you're essentially a voice in the wilderness at that point, just trying to get a few people to look around and say, no, really, this isn't what you're being told. At least take a step back and try to look into that. But, you know, the storm came on pretty hard and fast. And so,
Oh, it was completely overwhelming. I mean, the only reason I could handle myself is because, number one, I'm not really that worried about this kind of claim of an illness. I mean, I didn't think I was going to catch anything. I just contacted herbalists and homeopaths and doctors, and based on what the information we were being given in February and March, prepared to treat the sick. Now, one thing I found was very strange was I have yet to see a newspaper article or television spot let's go back to 2020, of anyone talking about taking care of sick people. They were all about waiting for the vaccine or hospitalization. You would think that if there is a pandemic, there's going to be a lot of people homesick and a lot of husbands and wives going to have to care for their spouse or their child or something like that. I never saw that issue come up.
Yes. You know, I don't think we heard about much of anything, even from the skeptics on some of the really more fundamental issues. It seemed to me that there were all sorts of branches of narrative reinforcement that was occurring, even amongst those who are a little bit doubtful. And perhaps that was because socially there was just so much pressure to become a part of this big event, that you had to be attached to this big event in some way and believe that some version of it was the reality. If you didn't, then you would be one who is living outside of that entire reality, and so for a lot of people that would put you in a position where you're fairly isolated.
Yeah, and people are going to tell you that you're crazy for not believing in this thing that they believe in but is not visibly apparent.
Yeah. So if we could, I would like to kind of go back to you know, the notion of the Great Barrington Declaration and some of the issues surrounding the health movement, per se, health freedom movement,
per se.
Let's
get a date on that. That's the summer of 20, right?
That's the summer of 20 with the Great Barrington Declaration.
I was gonna bring
that up to date with, you know, what was primarily a conference yesterday about vaccine damages.
Oh, you mean the Ron Johnson's hearing that took place?
Yeah, the hearing that. You know, it was excellent to have this hearing and focus on the damages and what seems to be a fair level of manipulation, cooked data, and all this in bringing these injections out into the world. Probably a fair pile of fraud, which wouldn't be the first time for these companies, but. What was problematic in that meeting, what I found to be problematic in that meeting, and it connects to the same strand, the same thread, the same themes that are recurring in the health freedom movement, is that this notion that there is some contagion, some virus out there that had to be handled, and that there was this terrible pandemic out there that was coming at us that had to be handled kept being perpetuated throughout this meeting, even though the meeting was primarily about the vaccine damage. And the individuals in that meeting, I'm not trying to impugn anybody's motives here, were some of the individuals who were at the forefront of promoting things such as the Great Barrington Declaration, and are still at the forefront of saying, yes, this is the narrative.
And well, yes, they all were under the pandemic scenario. I watched about an hour and a half of it. They're all, no one questioning the pandemic scenario.
And so to my mind, what's deeply problematic with, you know, these narratives that continue to perpetuate what is, you know, this big lie, is that it covers up the crimes of what actually happened and prevents us from having that discussion. So as all of these poor, disabled, elderly people are being killed in March and April of 2020, okay, through administrative policies, through, horrendous hospital protocols through isolation and so on. We're not having that discussion right now. You know, there are some outliers that are, but that's not the primary discussion.
No, the whole question has been squashed. The whole question of what is actually happening, and there was some of that early on, but I noticed that the thing called the Health Freedom Movement changed very rapidly through 2020. And then it's going on the ground. There's people having meetings. There was folding chairs meetings and various other meetings. A lot of meetings in people's homes all through 2020. And then, like, leaders start to emerge at the end of 2020. There's a big shift in October. But the fundamental thing that's not questioned by most of it, I mean, at ArcLight, they were questioning it. I saw places they were. But for the most part, 90% of your health freedom movement is not questioning the pandemic scenario. They believe there was a virus. They believe there was a viral outbreak.
Yeah, they do. They seem to either believe that the virus was, you know, an organic virus in nature that just happens to have some particularly virulent qualities to it, or that it was a gain of function lab leak virus that was and that seems to be the one that right now is
it's required. Yeah, it's required.
that's probably the most perpetuated theory right now on the origins of the virus, that it was created in the lab in China and then somehow has either been purposely leaked or escaped from the lab and then has created this mass death event. But there are many holes in that theory for as well. You know, I believe that that's just another aspect of the COVID fraud. And I've been saying this for 2 years, you know, and a lot of these people, to my mind, that are perpetuating this are just still in some version of this COVID merry-go-round.
Yes.
And I think that lab leak theory falls apart on its face for a number of reasons. You know, if you believe that COVID was a bioweapon, then I think that's cause for celebration, that we know that this bioweapon isn't very potent, as it seemed to only impact 80-year-olds with 4-plus comorbidities who were crammed into hospitals, nursing homes, and neglected, and had other loads of toxic pharmaceuticals jammed into their bodies, as well as vents and remdesivir and all of this. So I think that's kind of illustrates that there's at least one huge question. There's a lot of others as well, you know. So, how did this lab leak, this gain-of-function virus, impact only exclusively poor and disabled people? How did it stay away from, you know, upper middle class and wealthy people?
Well, even prisons. I mean, if there were really a viral outbreak, this should have devastated prisons. The homeless should have been wiped out. They were not. So what I noticed about the health freedom thing is it starts with these folding chairs meetings and meetings in people's homes and little potlucks and various gatherings and kind of Thanksgiving Day resistance. But then it moves into a bunch of millionaires leading this elusive thing. Right? We've got millionaires like Malone, McCullough, RFK, Del Bigtree. It's become a kind of a Big Ten thing.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know any of those individuals personally, and I personally view them each differently, but you do see that in movements, and I think some of this is normal because they already have a platform. You know, RFK already has an enormous platform, so this is, you know, I think a very natural
progression
situation
of his business,
for him, and I think the same is true with Del Bigtree. And I would, you know, say that they have both done amazing work through their careers specific to the issue of vaccines, and have educated a tremendous amount of people on that. I do think, and would love to have the discussion with them in person, that they're terribly wrong on the notion of the genesis of this operation, and that they do still both, as far as I understand it, and I listened to them very closely, believe that there was a viral event that merited attention in 2020, and so they're missing the larger picture, which to me is a profound mystery, for some other reasons that I think I'll skip over now.
But I'm really interested in the persistence and the pushing of the absolute unquestionable fact of a viral event by the health freedom movement and not questioning it. It's a huge deal when they question it. When for example, CHD TV had Mike Wallach on with his documentary, that was like a huge dramatic event because he was questioning the entire claim of viral outbreaks. It was the same when Andy Kaufman and Lanka appeared in 2021 or early 22. They appeared on Reiner Filmic's panel. Big deal. Oh, and no virus people are appearing. Oh my God, hold your breath.
Yeah, well, it's a mystery to me. For example, I'll just use this one example. There are many. So Del Bigtree is interviewing a couple of individuals who have had family members killed by the hospital protocols, okay? Mm-hmm. And it was a great interview, and it's great to get that exposure, and that certainly needs to be highlighted even more, and because it will give people a clear picture of what actually happened. And so how he can have that interview, and he's on board with it. He knows that these people are giving him exquisite detail, okay, and that this was widespread and this happened throughout this country and other countries, and then how you can go from that and understand those stories, accept those stories, and then just segue back to, yes, there was this unique viral pathogen, when these individuals just told you no, something else happened. That's to me, mm-hmm. Quite curious. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now I saw that interview that you're referencing. Okay, with Andrew Kaufman and Stefan Lanka, and they were fairly well. I thought Reiner was pretty open with them and was maybe a little curious to hear what they're speaking about. However, I felt like Wolfgang Wodarg, who did amazing work on exposing the 2009 swine flu hoax, he shut that down pretty much and actually was fairly intolerant and aggressive, mm-hmm. towards them. And if you watch that interview, let's forget about you're going to, quote-unquote, take sides with one or the other. If you just look at the dynamics of the conversation, to me it's a little irresponsible at best from Wolfgang Wodarg. And they're not showing too much, and you see this happening again and again when the quote unquote no virus people are in these discussions, the few discussions that they're involved in that they're really attacked. And it's interesting that the people such as Wolfgang don't understand the dynamic of how they are being attacked, Wolfgang Wodarg, for example, by, let's say, the PR people from Big Pharma or, mm-hmm. the government representatives. So they're essentially doing that same thing to this other group that is really just saying, hey, look at this.
Yeah. And they have their data straight. I know every single person's position, and they have their information organized. For them to not acknowledge the issue, really acknowledge and say there is a question here. at minimum, you would have to say that if you looked at the data. To then just blank that, basically, to me, it's almost as if when I hear somebody like RFK or Del Bigtree talking to me these days, it sounds like Fauci. They're taking the same position that Fauci took, with minor flourishes, but still different, but still it's the same core concept. There was a virus, there was a pandemic. Okay, maybe there was an what Robert F. Kennedy in his book called a mismanaged pandemic. But the difference between a mismanaged pandemic and a complete hoax is a very big difference.
Yes, you know, and I guess I would almost have a problem with calling it a hoax, too, myself. I mean, these were, you know, this is a huge money laundering operation. It is racketeering, and there were some identifiable crimes committed every step of the way, and we get further and further from looking at those questions, from identifying what those crimes were, and from isolating on who those individuals were who were committing those crimes, both at the micro and the macro level, as long as you believe that there was this big event. Mm-hmm. So I believe that, you know, I do think the tide is going to turn again, you know, because the evidence, just the hard data and the evidence is absolutely irrefutable as to what happened in March and April 2020. If anyone listening here will just click on an interview by someone like Dennis Rancourt, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, Dennis Rancourt doesn't argue the no virus or there is a virus, okay? He hasn't broached that topic yet. But if you just listen to him for but one example, there are others, talk about the series of events that happened and how they happened, this is not compatible with how it's being described by some of the premier folks like Robert Malone, premier in quotes, Robert Malone, Pierre Corey, who I think is a man of integrity. I just think he's really blind in this area. And some of these others, these two discussions are not compatible.
Yeah. So let's talk about those couple of months and what you see having happened in March and April of 20, rather than what we're told happened.
What happened is a byproduct of, as I see it, is a byproduct of the fact that the economies of the West had completely collapsed in 2019. And this is a vestige from 2008, 2009, even preceding that, but we'll just leave it there. And so at that point in 2019, they're pumping $10 billion a day into the repo market to try to keep this thing afloat. And then they get to the point where they're at $20 billion a day. And then they're at $100 billion a day. And essentially, this could not go on. These economies were in free fall.
When was this? This is in 19? This is going
this
on?
This is in 2019. So they knew this, and there was a need to stop this economy, this economic activity from occurring, and to slow this train down. And in my view, that is what happened in March 11th. They Right. decided to essentially shut the door on the world's economies, on the Western world's economies.
And, to cool everything off, because it was just running out of control.
Yeah.
And essentially, it was really a junk in the belly of the beast thing, just like it was in 2008. Is that
yeah,
right?
And, yeah, and...
What was the weak security? What was the junk exactly? Repos?
Yeah, the repo market is... essentially, where the banks will go, each morning to have liquidity in their bank so that they can open their doors. Okay, so if the banks don't have 10% liquid assets, they're not allowed to open the next day. And so, you know, you're looking at, by the time we're in the middle of September, there's $20 billion a day being kept pumped into the repo markets to keep the interest rates down. Okay, so these banks can borrow money to stay in business. And by the time we're at the end of December, the Fed's pumping $100 billion per day into the repo market.
In what form? What are they buying to do that?
So essentially, Wall Street is just loaded with debt. Okay, and then in March 2020, they're spreading this liquidity crisis from these too big to fail banks, and they're gonna bail them out again.
Okay, so what I hear you saying is that the entire pandemic scenario was a scrim for a financial meltdown that created a huge smokescreen so that all this money could change hands right behind the scenes.
I wouldn't say it was behind the scenes, but yeah, you know, you did have to pay attention some, but you know, we can see pretty clearly what was that they did transfer this money into these financiers so that their financial system wouldn't collapse. And I don't say that that is the only part of the COVID phenomena. I think it's connected to larger geopolitical events. My personal view of it now is that, you know, the end game is to get people to central bank digital currency. We had talked about that in our previous conversation. And, you know, how I'm still trying to work this through, but one of the major items that has been able to keep the U.S. Financial system and its allies who are connected to it afloat are the petrodollars. And I tend to believe now that the central bank digital currency is also a part of, essentially, the petrodollars are becoming weakened. Okay, countries are trying to get out of that stranglehold. Okay, big energy producing countries. And so I believe that in large part the financial systems of the West are going to attempt to use the central bank digital currency as some form of replacement of their petrodollar as the petrodollar becomes weaker and weaker. And I think we're in the midst of that, and that's why we're experiencing hyperinflation, or at least part of it.
Is this connected to peak oil? Was that another factor going on in 19 and early 20?
You know, I used to study that a lot, and I can't say that I am convinced with the argument of peak oil now as I was then. The one thing that still stands out to me is that the oil does seem that they are having to go further afield to find it, and I do believe the energy return on the energy investment on peak oil is much smaller than it was. I do believe there's still a lot of energy out there. Mm-hmm. And it's more who's controlling it than the actual amount of it.
Right. So the decline in 19 and 20 was not necessarily a thing related to oil running out, but obviously that fear is in the background of everyone's mind and fueling various shades of panic.
I would answer that question now with saying I don't believe it was, mm-hmm. but allow me to edit that answer maybe a few months or a few years from now, mm-hmm. As I have read certain hypotheses that are suggesting that this is, you know, in response to energy, the perceived need for winding down high energy economies of the West. I'm not convinced that's the case, but I think, you know, you should keep the door open for looking at it.
Right. So the by the petrodollar, you mean the dollar used as the basis for transacting petroleum transactions?
Yes, which is essentially a tithe to the U.S. banking system.
Right. And so with this whole system weakened by debt, weakened by now by inflation and interest rates, you're thinking that a replacement for this system, broken system, is going to be sold to the public as the central bank digital currency?
I do. I think that, you know, it has various facets to it. One is to control economic and social behavior within that country itself. And I think, and given the fact that we are going to see a decline in the standard of living in these countries, we are seeing it, that there's going to be a fair amount of social unrest. This can be a tool for governments to control any sort of social upheavals that may be a result of that. But I'm, you know, I right now, I don't think I would have even, I don't think I'd given this enough thought a month ago. I do think that the central bank digital currencies are the biggest emphasis for them is going to be for the central banks, banking system of the West to control international transactions. I think that's what I would say about that right now.
The banking system of the West wants to take over. Where is the banking system of the West? Where's the capital of capital?
That might depend on who you ask. Some would say London. Okay. So okay. So I don't put a specific location to it. You know, it's Wall Street and BIS in London and banking system in London.
And what would it mean for them to control all those other transactions?
You would have to go through them. So you're going to have to go through. Okay, so for example, now, what keeps the dollar strong? One of the things that keeps the dollar strong, as we mentioned, is the petrodollar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if, for example, Iran and the Czech Republic are going to do an energy deal, and they don't have to use the petrodollar, then the U.S. banking system loses its cut.
Ah.
If
they can buy oil in euros or in something else, Bitcoin, the Western banking system loses its percentage.
Or the yuan, or the ruble.
Sure, right.
Or et cetera, okay, which I would say is more of a focal point right now for the U.S. financial system. If they have to go through the central banking digital currency, then we're back to this being a tithe to that system.
So you're foreseeing the possibility that the petroleum transactions themselves could be made onto like the oil crypto, like oil coin or something like that, which is really the seed central bank digital currency, but it becomes the oil currency.
Yeah, as I'm saying that, though, I'm not specifically referring or exclusively referring to oil. You know, I'm speaking in terms of just all sorts of market transactions that are happening between various countries.
Right.
And, you know, I've really just been thinking about this in the last several weeks, and it's interesting if you go back, and there's this really known video, short video, it's only 45 seconds, and there's the gentleman from Mexico, and I don't recall his name, but this one's all over the internet, and he's speaking about central bank digital currency, and this is, he really refers to this point. You know, he's not speaking about the central bank digital currency in terms of individuals per se, but it's in terms of how this will allow them to surveil and control all of these international market transactions.
Okay, this is what you were getting at last week, where you a couple of weeks ago you said, well, you're not sure that the central bank digital is something that's going to be immediately applied to people, but rather to business transactions?
Well, that's where the money is.
Because there's such a huge volume going by.
Yeah.
That it's much bigger than the consumer economy, are you saying?
Yes, and I think that it also is going to take a much longer period for this to be given credibility in just the consumer transaction. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's going to take a little longer effort to convince at least the consumers in some of the major Western countries that this is for their benefit.
Right, but it'll be easier to implement on the higher levels structurally.
Yes.
Okay, but meanwhile, if we're still thinking of COVID as some kind of a health scenario and not a total diversion for a much huger crime, then we're really not talking about the same thing, which is why to emphasize virus and pandemic and all this stuff, to keep repeating that lie is to completely sidetrack us from the massive restructuring of society that is going on, for which this was a cover story.
I believe so. I think the evidence is all around us as well. And I guess one thing I fear with the perpetuation of this narrative is that a version of it can be rolled out mm-hmm. again. So let's just take the lab leak example. If it is accepted at face value, then, that the origins of COVID were from this lab leak, what's to prevent the powers that be from saying, well, now we are going to have to be, we admit it. We were wrong at the time not to tell you about this, but we didn't know what to do. We feared that this could create mass panic, as if there wasn't that already, and so forth. But yes, there was a lab leak, and now we're afraid Saddam Hussein has been resurrected, and we have a potential lab leak coming from Iraq. Of course, that story is absurd, but what about...
It worked a lot of times. Listen, the Iraq story worked for a quarter century of war. So it could be anybody. It could be any Ukrainian bioweapons lab, you know, gets bombed by the Russians, and then...
Yeah.
Suddenly, you know, they tell us that everybody's dropping dead in Ukraine and nobody can check.
Right. So they can use that fear narrative, you know, and recycle whatever version of it that they like. Okay, which is, you know, the playbook that's been, you know, used for many, many decades. Whereas if people understand that, wait a minute, no, the narrative here is that. These psychotic billionaires who control the direction of the world's economy actually have this plan that they have unfolded upon us, and it has nothing to do with, you know, a viral event. Then people are able to more clearly see and ideally understand what response they need to have for this kind of event. But you know, if we can't get off this belief that there was this medical emergency, I don't see any way where we're going to address these larger issues, where if we can't even talk about them.
Yeah, and this to me is the frightening thing. And look, you can say that if you know, I read an article you sent me, you're proposing that there was this diversionary event for an economic crime committed. My specialty has been the biology of this, and there's not one thing from the medical or biological angle that supports that there was any kind of a viral event. The patterns of spread, the lack of locations, the lack of the, those two things alone, the infection fatality rate listed now at something like 3 per 10,000, the lack of excess deaths in any category. There was no pandemic, because if there was one, we would have had some of those metrics jumping off the chart, but they were not. So that says there's something else going on here.
Right. There's anywhere you look, the data does seem to scream at you that there was no pandemic whatsoever, you know. And I believe that, you know, these sorts of, you know, the lab leak theory, you know, it reinforces the entire notion that, you know, this viral event is a real problem that needs to be solved.
Yes.
Rather than it's a fear-based control narrative.
Well, it's a perfect parachute.
Yeah. I like to say that this virus was birthed in the corporate boardrooms of, you know, big finance and big pharma, and it was the only place it was leaked was in a memo.
Yeah, it was a press release leak. In the most recent revision of the chronology, we went looking for the earliest references in the press to lab leak, specifically related to the COVID scenario. And there was a story in the London Daily Mail, or maybe the Mail on Sunday, on the 23rd of January, and the very next day, The Lancet, a medical journal in England, published an article saying effectively that the wet market theory had failed because 13 people claimed to be sick had not the least contact tracing to the market, meaning that they couldn't say that was their sole point source. It was over. But the day before, the lab leak story came out, and they had their B scenario, their second plot.
Mm-hmm.
A day.
Yeah, I guess one of the problems. One of the problems for us is that you know, we look at this stuff and we remember it and we keep it.
Yeah.
And there's just so much information that is coming at people nonstop all day. They'll forget this pretty quickly. And so the contradictions that are stand out to people who are tracking this daily and documenting it are rather glaring. If you're not doing that, you know, you kind of go willy-nilly to one theory to the next, you know, and you can get wrapped up into some fairly esoteric stuff. And then you will kind of just rely on your trusted sources. And many of these trusted sources, even if they have good intentions, aren't looking at this data and evidence either.
Or Catherine Austin Fitz says, no, the lab, whether there is a virus is a diversion. Don't worry about it. Mark Crispin Miller said that. Celia Farber's position is basically that. Many people are saying, nah, this whole battle of whether there's a virus or not, forget about it. It's not that important. And I'm thinking, no, this remains the most important issue, because their entire plan is based on forced injections for alleged viruses. They shut down China again. The reason there's protests is because they locked places down again for nothing. They know there's not a viral outbreak.
Well, I think, you know, I would separate those individuals that you mentioned a little bit to my mind, okay? Catherine Austin Fitz, Mark Crispin Miller. And I think Catherine Austin Fitz, and I think I've seen almost everything she's put out. And I think she's a really good source for people to go to. And I think that what she is saying is she's not really taking a position there. You know, she's saying that let's focus on the crimes that we know were committed. Okay? And I agree with that. I don't I don't know that, because here's one thing that I've considered. If we were able to prove that there was no virus, and to my mind, the proof that there is a virus is thin to non-existent, okay? But let's just put that aside for the moment. These people could invent the spaghetti monster and would. They will invent, you know, deadly leaves falling from the tree are all of a sudden toxic. And,
kitty,
you know,
cat
that,
flu.
Yes. Catherine Austin Fitz is saying, no, we know these were our human human-engineered events. Let's stay with that focus. And I think anyone who goes and listens to her discussions will see that she has some pretty watertight hypotheses on these things and has quite a bit of an experience with these individuals and these institutions, I should say. So I'm not sure that, you know, she is opposed to entertaining that. I think she's just simply saying at this point that's not strategically the best way. I personally feel, I think as I alluded to the last time we spoke, that a better way to do it is to go through, sort of go through the back door. And, you know, if we're in a room and we get 100 people there and they're really open to listening to there is no pandemic, and we start off by saying, you know, there was no pandemic, here are the crimes that were committed. I think we've got at least 99 of them are going to sit there and say, I want to hear the rest of this. If you go into that room and you immediately say, there's no virus, and then you're going to do the crimes later, you're going to lose a lot of people.
Yeah, no, right, I'm not talking about, like, the rhetorical presentation. You know, I prefer to not use the terminology no virus. I prefer to explain it in more detail. And, for example, say that what they're testing for has never been shown to come from a virus, match a virus, or cause a disease. First of all, that's the nature of the fraud, is that they got a test, they're claiming it's a test for an infection, but it can't do that, and it is not searching for anything vaguely related to a virus. So there's a lot of ways to say that, and I think, yes, you have to speak the language of your audience, and I don't think that means that you're compromising your integrity by doing that.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty amazing, you know, for, I don't know, just on a more, you know, just a layperson's thought is, you know, for these, to believe that there are these floating microbes that are causing this much mischief when we can just look at the evidence to point exactly to where the mischief is coming from is to me, pretty breathtaking. You know, that's just amazing to believe that. To believe that there are these floating microbes that are creating all of this harm, and even if you believe that these floating microbes can do some harm and that they exist and they're real, whatever that would be is minuscule compared to the actual thing that's out there trying to flatten everybody's lives. So that's maybe a big thing that's hard for people to psychologically come to terms with. So, so I would say, you know, the COVID-19 has just never been an epidemiological emergency. It's primarily about the collapse of the financial system and the protection of that financial system. And that financial system is what is the empire.
Yes. Yep. You know, we began on the topic of the health freedom movement. One of the things that I was disappointed by greatly was that I thought when this started, you know, when it's starting to look like it's not going to go away in early March, I thought this is going to be the biggest boon ever for the alternative health movement. Finally, the alternative health movement is going to come into its own, because this is so obviously a thing that, whatever it might be, can be handled by nutritional interventions and homeopathy and herbalism. And that was shocking in how it was flattened, sold out, bought out, co-opted, and became kind of the very capital of masking.
Well, you know, another aspect of this to me, Eric, is where we're now seeing this. Well, I don't think ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine sales have ever been so voluminous. Okay, I don't think people have pumped so much vitamin D, vitamin C, and I'm not saying any of this is bad. This is great, you know, in their bodies as we've seen. So it seems to me that people still are looking for some sort of quick solution and maybe some magic bullet to prevent them from getting ill or to prevent them from getting COVID. I still believe in COVID, quote unquote. When, you know, it doesn't have to, you know, the health freedom movement, to my mind, should, in parts of it do, shouldn't have much to do with simply taking another pill to treat a disease, if that's what you believe it is. I think that's problematic. I believe that, you know, it is, again, wholesale changes in the medical model, elimination of the current medical model, and wholesale changes in the social and environmental and nutritional habits that need to be the focal point of the health freedom movement.
Yeah, I mean, I had to think this through a lot of times, and you know, why, for example, health food stores were some of the most militant places in terms of masking and social distancing. And we had one here that arrested two people. I think that there's a lot of magical thinking going on by those who are in the health food store.
Yeah, I agree. You know, this same phenomena is where I live. You know, we have one of the largest co-ops in the Northeast here, and it is still a place of high level neuroses. So maybe it was always that way, you know, and maybe that's what drew many of the people to such a place, that they felt like they would still have eternal life if they, you know, just had a little extra spirulina or something. Yeah, I don't know if I fully understood how it is that people who I have been on the front lines with in opposing GMOs for years, and people who are, you know, attuned to the corruption of the pharmaceutical industry and have been for years and have been on the streets protesting with them about these things, all of a sudden flipped a switch and have put their faith and their health in these very things that they had been opposing for a couple of decades. And I will say this, and this isn't just anecdotal, or well, I suppose it is anecdotal, but I'm looking at it carefully and repeatedly. The condition of the individuals who are attending, you know, going to this co-op, it is not good. You know, their health has deteriorated significantly in the last few years due to, you know, any number of factors that we could point to.
Right. Yeah.
For what that's worth.
Well, it's there's a lot of things that could have impacted them. But what I thought was, they're really, Rockefeller Medicine is really scoring a big one on homeopathy and herbalism quackery, just like it's done so many times before. They were able to basically reel back in many of their, the people resisting their whole model were suddenly dragged back in.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing to me to see that these, what I thought to be some fairly clear-thinking people get eaten alive by this fear in the last 3 years, you know, and I've had many heated discussions with some of these individuals in the last 3 years. And, you know, and I've also had some discussions where you're really just trying to ask them to think this through. You know, have you looked at this? Have you looked at this? And it's very difficult to break through that wall right now.
Yeah, it is. And it's especially difficult, I think, given that I don't like it when you settle into a thing where you've got like four main sources. And even if they were pre-existing, Big Tree's completely co-opted this. RFK is co-opted. There's the big players. You know, there's the big famous guys, inventors. There's just so many millionaires in charge of this. Steve Kirsch is another one. I look at these guys and they're investment people, and they have investments, and they don't, a lot of them don't need to work another day in their lives, and that's who we're being told is in the primary leadership of this health freedom movement. I find it to be very distressing.
Yeah, there are some individuals that have arisen, and I do sometimes wonder where they came from. You know, how did they get to that position? You know, it's the RFKs and Del Big Trees, as I mentioned, they've been there for a long time. They've been there for a large for a significant involvement in tangential aspects to what would be, you know, misnamed a pandemic. So it's a very natural evolution for them to be, you know, quote unquote, at the forefront of this, particularly when, you know, the vaccine comes in to play. But I like you, I find it very very problematic that they're not continuously digging and exploring the deeper facets of what has happened. You know, one, and I've had this conversation with someone that I'm pretty close to now, and they're, you know, I would say not on the front lines, but somewhat influential in the health freedom movement, and is definitely aware of all the issues that that have been forced upon us in the last 3 years. And one of the things that really bothers me is that, again, in March and April, it was the elderly, primarily, mm-hmm. not exclusively, mm-hmm. but primarily, that had the last few months of their lives, the dignity and the grace of those last few months, just wiped out.
Yep.
And this was actively done.
Yes.
And it was used also to induce the fear and the hysteria. So not only were their lives foreshortened, but they were used, okay, to kickstart this entire program. And here we are 3 years later. I don't hear anybody talking about that. I don't hear anybody or see anybody saying, you know what, we need to prosecute these people who were responsible for that. And that is obviously ethically and morally problematic. I also think it's strategically, if you just wanted to use that kind of clinical conceptualization of it, a really bad decision, because from the public's perception, you know, the whole save granny phenomena,
mm-hmm.
really caught on. This was one of the PR moves that was, you know, genius by these deviants, okay?
Yeah.
And if people in the health movement understood that, wait, the reality was inverse to what we were being told, we can utilize that to completely shift public sentiment. So I talked to someone about that, and they simply thought that, you know, it was just going to be too difficult of a case to be made, both legally and in the media. And I disagree.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of excuses made, like the public is not ready to know. They'll think we've gone too far. I see a lot of people protecting, and this all comes down to the virus. it all comes down to either questioning or admitting, you know, for example, that as of now, 213 governments and institutions around the world have said they don't have a sample of this thing taken from a human. I don't think we need to prove anything else about whether there was a virus or not, because all of these institutions, and by the way, out of those 213, I've got a separate list of 10 alone that come from CDC. They're not counted as 10. They're counted as one in the 213, I think, is the head count today. They've admitted this. And this is a very, very uncomfortable fact for people to consider.
So to your mind, what is it that you think prohibits some of the individuals within that have maybe a little more national recognition from exploring, not agreeing, not even accepting this kind of a viewpoint? What do you think it is that prohibits them from just exploring it, from having more curiosity about it?
Hold on, I'll read you the RFK quote. Quote, this is, I know for sure this was written by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Quote, it's written to a famous medical doctor who's one of the more radical people on the COVID actual truth side of this. He said, quote, I'm grateful for your courage and intellectual integrity. I have an open mind on this issue, meaning the virus existence, but no bandwidth to spend the time and energy and credibility capital to personally investigate it. That's a lot in that first two sentences. He's grateful to this doctor's courage and intellectual integrity. I have an open mind on this issue, but no bandwidth to spend the time, energy, and credibility capital to personally investigate it. I feel the same way toward people who passionately and knowledgeably argue that 9/11 is an inside job. It could be true, but there are opportunity costs in taking on this cause, and I think diminishing returns to my overall effectiveness. I cannot right every wrong or expose every falsehood. I need to be strategic in choosing my battles. If you reflect, you'll find that you do the same. I admire your courage. I admire and encourage you, but I must beg off on this war for the time being. Here's the catch. I'm more likely to join if you get nearer the goal line, where the cost returns ratio improves. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., August 11th, 2022.
So as I see it, you know, I think that's a statement to learn from, you know, for us, that then says to me, maybe I'm just hearing it the way I wish it to be, is indeed that if we're able to take this narrative that there was no medical event that caused what we're experiencing, that it was this more of a geopolitical administrative event, and we are able to get more a greater public sentiment behind that, then this is something that inevitably they will have to confront. One of the issues there, though, is how do you get there if they're not open to having the conversation?
Yeah.
I would love to see, let's have Dennis Roncourt sit in a room, okay, with RFK and with Peter McCullough, all right, and have this discussion, all right, and mm-hmm. and let's have a nice, long, extended, honest debate about these issues. I'm afraid that, you know, if we're 20 minutes into it, it's going to be very difficult for them to withstand just the rigorous and detailed amount of data and evidence that Mr. Roncourt is able to. Mm-hmm. To put forth. It's
Yeah, and he's looking at the outside. He's saying, were there a pandemic, it should have looked like this, but it didn't.
This is correct. Well, and I think one of the things that is also brought up is that, look, this event wiped out, in the United States alone, wiped out around 1.3 million poor people. Okay, so I think that's another, that's just a...
Wiped out by interventions? They were killed by mitigation measures?
Yeah, by hospital protocols, by isolation, by lockdowns, by all of these sorts of things, okay? Mm-hmm. Things that are, you know, you put any sort of social, economic hardships out into the world, and even if you apply them equally, they are never applied equally, but even if you were, they're going to impact the most vulnerable, which are always the poor. And so this is who was impacted in the last 2.5 to 3 years. Why are people not really focusing on this if you're a champion of the people? And again, I'm not impugning anyone's motive here. I'm just saying that this is what happened. Okay, and there's a mountain of evidence to illustrate this. Let's focus on these crimes, and when we do that, you know, that's where you amass public sentiment, because these are the people who saw that, you know, their family members impacted by this, and are willing to step forward and be a part of something if they see that it addresses them. But, you know, like so many of these things, I think this would be interesting to do if we could, is I would just like to see the demographics of the health freedom movement.
Well, it's built largely of Christians. They've stepped out. So it's, I think, mostly right-leaning people, mostly right-leaning Christians, and then you have a lot of anti-war left, like old-school left defectors who are not Trump supporters, but say, for example, were accused of being Trump supporters because they weren't going along with the plan. And so at a lot of events, I was finding a good few, like moderate Christian Republicans out through fundamentalist Christians meeting with these like a lot of people who are shaken off this, the old left who do not meet the new left, fuck you, this new version of the pro CIA left as opposed to the anti CIA left.
Well, I'm thinking more in terms of, you know, maybe I should have said
monetary status, race.
Yeah.
I saw middle class people, and I saw white middle class people, right, mostly right leaning.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, where, to my mind, if there is going to be any meaningful movement, it's going to be involving and optimally led by the poor, mm-hmm. You know, by people who are most impacted by these horrendous policies, and that's what they were policies, mm-hmm. You know, whether this was the medical policies within the hospitals or the government policies that were impacting the communities, that's what was destroying people. And so, yeah, you know, I've been as I think, you know, I've been immersed in the health freedom movement in the last few years here, and I do wonder sometimes why there's not a substantial subset of those who are, impacted the most involved in the health freedom movement. What is that? So I don't know the answer, but I've thought about it.
I would propose that the people who are hurt the most were actually the middle class. Because people who are very low on the food chain tend to have fairly stable existence, and they're always getting the raw deal anyway. That the real attack, like many things, came to those people who had a little bit more than out to small business scale people, And then your wealthy are not really going to be impacted too much. Because
I guess what I was referencing there was just directly to the people who were killed, you know. So, and those are almost universally poor.
Mm-hmm.
Poor, so. But yeah, hey, may I read this?
Yeah, sure.
Before we
what you got?
Forward. Okay. COVID-19 has never been about an epidemiological emergency. It is about the collapse of the financial system. COVID-19 is designed for 1, redistribution of wealth, aka theft from the poor and middle class to the insanely rich. 2, fear-induced digital enslavement, the Great Reset, Fourth Industrial Revolution. 3, pharma making trillions in profit and introduction of the mRNA gravy train. 4, constant bailouts for the financial sector. 5, entrenchment of the biosecurity state. Rather than focus on the manufactured in silico disease, it's best to focus on the crimes committed, such as, but not limited to, 1, largest transfer of wealth to the investor class in history, 2, slaughter of elderly in care homes through forced improper medical protocols, 3, destruction of millions of businesses through illegal policies, 4, fraudulent trials and marketing of experimental medical product, 5, reckless endangerment of the public through forced inoculations, 6, media manipulation of public using illegal fear tactics to induce compliance, 7, purposeful abuse of children through various lockdown policies, masks, trauma, etc. COVID-19, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and Great Reset are all massive frauds to create a series of monopolies, cartels, and oligopolies that govern food, energy, healthcare, and the most basic parts of our lives. The plan is for a new phase of global capitalism enabled by national states and governments, international organizations and quangos such as the EU, UN, NATO, IMF, WTO, WHO, Gates Foundation, Gavi, with no clear lines between state and non-state actors. Mm-hmm. So that's how I see this cataclysmic event, which has been happening over the last 2.5 years and which is ongoing. And it's up to us to fight back and resist this tyranny.
Yeah, and to remember that we're not part of this globalist jurisdiction. I mean, what you're describing is this blending of private and government policy and control is dictionary definition fascism, first of all. And second, an international jurisdiction has been created where before there was none. And it's been facilitated by the internet and all these huge international NGOs like the World Health Organization and the World Trade Organization and the World Economic Forum.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I do think now is the time, though. I think that I'm feeling a little bit of a shift in that's, you know, I'm not sitting here saying I have the evidence to back up what right now is just an intuition. But in the overall discussion about this is starting to shift. I do think people are seeing more so that if the discussion is simply sitting there about the vaccine injuries, which is a very important and necessary discussion. If the discussion is just sitting there focused on a virus and so forth, that these are dead ends and that people are seeing that there is some leviathan that is at work here,
mm-hmm.
that is really trying to roll over all of our lives, and that this COVID thing is just one part of this operation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we need to beware for the next type of similar thing. It is difficult to prepare people, and it always comes from a slightly or radically different direction. I don't think they're going to be knocking down skyscrapers again anytime soon. I'm not sure they could pull off another claimed pandemic, but they may be able to have sufficient fear to roll in a kind of a digital vaccine passport.
But Eric, can I finish with this thought?
Oh, sure.
So this goes to something you had just said, where we are told, you know, oh, we can't talk about this, or we can't talk about this, because then people are going to be alienated from that discussion, or they're just not ready for it, or the, you know, all this sort of stuff.
When
right?
you're 13, I'll tell you, when you're 13.
Yeah, and, you know, I kind of chafe at that, and the reason I do is I have these conversations with, you know, everyday people all of the time, of which I am one, okay? And I don't find anybody thinking, oh, that's too radical, that's too outside of the, you know, even the box I'm willing to go into. When you speak, I think when you speak to, you know, look, these are some enormous, powerful forces out there that want to control your every move, that want to control your life. Most people that I encounter that are, you know, not part of the health freedom movement or not part of any movement at all, most of the time just say, tell me something I don't know. Oh, yes, I'm aware of that. And so when you come at it from that perspective, you can then start to talk about these other things. They're open to it. I don't see that people are saying to, in the conversations I have, I don't know that I've ever once said, oh, that's just too far-fetched to believe. Mm-hmm. These kind of things we were just talking about today.
Yeah, I hear a bit of it, like a little bit of maybe, you know, you'll never convince me there's no such thing as a communicable disease, but it's like, okay, look, you know, germ theory has never been so questioned as it is now. Whatever else may have gone on in the last 1,000 and whatever days, there is actually discussion about germ theory going on.
And all of these conversations can be happening concurrently. We don't have to stay focused on, hey, just this. This is all you're allowed to be talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, you can, you know, you and I can disagree on these things and have these conversations concurrently. And it's okay.
Yeah, I tend to think people are more intelligent than they give themselves credit for, and more intelligent than, well, they might normally be were they not slammed on the head by something. And there's some laziness and some convenience and some, it's over, and some, but when you actually get someone to think, there is obviously an issue. Right, at least we want to get people to the point of a question. There's a question here.
Yeah, I think that you just have to be a little careful with the sort of elitism which believes that we, you know, we have the message that we will control, and you need to stay within that framework. So that's how I'll leave off there.
Yep. Well, that's certainly my philosophy as an interviewer. Let's get it out. Let's put it out on the table here. And, you know, people listen to a format like this, and they develop their own observations and come to their own conclusions. And I personally choose to trust the intellectual integrity of my audience.
Yes. Yeah. Just present the data and evidence and let people digest it, take it for themselves, question it, and explore, you know, their own routes for sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good. Listen, thank you so much for joining me for a second conversation. And I'm looking forward to posting your article to a couple of places, COVID-19 and Planet Waves FM, our daily blog that's been going now for, I think, something like 1,010 days, I think, we've maintained this thing. COVID-19 news.
Thanks for everything, Eric.
Incredibly. Okay, good. You too, and I'll catch you a little further down the road, Michael.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay.
Bless.
See you now.
Bye for now.